Turning Tides is an Antics Entertainment production. You can find the show on social media at the Turning Tides Podcast on Facebook, Instagram, Threads, and YouTube, and at Turning Tides Pod on Blue Sky and Mastodon. For more information, or if you're interested in sponsoring the podcast or collaborating, please contact us at theturningtidespodcast@gmail.com. Thank you. Warning, this episode of Turning Tides contains depictions of sexual assault.
Hello, everyone. I'm your host, Joseph Pascone. Thank you all so much for tuning in to this very special episode of the Turning Tides podcast. Today, we are joined by Wells Jones, co-author of the best-selling new book, A Line in the Sand, which tells the story of two friends on their time-traveling adventure across the Middle East. Mr. Jones, thank you so much for being on today. How are you doing?
Mr. Pascone, thank you for having me.
Anytime.
I'm good. I'm in Santa Fe. You're in Vegas. And the sun's shining. We're good.
That's all we can hope for at this point.
Yeah. We'll start with that and let it roll.
Yeah. So for those unfamiliar with you or your work, I'm just going to give you the floor for a moment so you can tell us about yourself.
Okay. I'm from a large family, military family. My father was an officer, a general's aide during Korea. I was born in Stuttgart, Germany. American parents, of course. A brother on my first birthday. And I'm saying this because this is really, you know, put the math together. Older twins and younger twins and a brother born on my first birthday. So there are six kids, three birthdays. We ended up in South Carolina. My siblings were born in different places in the United States, Fort Sill and in El Paso. And we ended up starting school in South Carolina, ended up moving to Vermont, which seemed like a very foreign land. It's the first time I saw snow. I was in fourth grade. Teachers said, hey, you know, it's snowing. Why don't we let Tad, it was the name that I was called, and go to the window and look out and look at the snow. And she said, go ahead, you can go. And I had to walk by all these desks. It's a very rural area. My graduating class was 31. And I just felt the anger, the look at this stupid guy. He doesn't even know what snow is. Well, anyway, I found out a lot about snow. I skied through high school, graduated, 31 people in the class, decided to go into the service, which was the best thing for me to do. I had a plan. The plan was changed to something even better. After that, I had generated a love for theater. Joe, I do call you Joe, right? Or Joseph?
Of course. Joe, Joseph. Whatever. Yeah.
Joseph. I mean, I'm fine with Joseph. That's cool. So Joseph, oh, yeah. I had a love for theater because it allowed me to play people. And in high school, you know, you're just such an amateur, but there was something about it that I liked. And after getting out of the Navy, not going the direction I really wanted to go, which was fly jets, go to, you know, 4 years college and go to aviation school. That was not going to happen. I'm 6'3" and my eyes were really bad. And my commanding officer said, son, it's not going to happen. So I ended up in Santa Barbara, started acting, and really it bit me big and I loved it. And we were acting with ACT people, American Conservatory actors that were in school in San Francisco, would come down for our repertory summer. And so I got a taste and was able to get some lead roles after a year there and work with wonderful people. And that's been my career. I've always been able to work with just such talented people in different disciplines. So anyway, went to New York instead of LA to really learn my craft. Went to the American Academy of Dramatic Arts, got out of there. Lee Strasberg just passed on. His son, John, was starting a repertory company with his wife. I got an audition. Bam. It happened, really, because he was looking at my meager resume. You know, I had a couple of shows from Santa Barbara and from the American Academy of Dramatic Arts. But at the bottom it said skills, and it said Antarctic Pararescue Team. And I was in the middle of my audition, like a monologue, and he said, stop. And I went, oh, Lord, here we go. I've heard about this rejection. I better just turn around and leave. And the guy said, come here, John Strasberg, tell me about Antarctica. And we had this conversation, and he said, great, I'll see you later. And I said, yeah, thank you. That was really nice. Turned around and turned back, and he said, wait a minute. He said, don't worry, you're in. You're in. I am? Yeah, you're in. And I know it was because of, I mean, I was, you know, a young amateur, just getting into the professional world of acting. But that got me going. I couldn't feed my family doing theater in New York. And there wasn't, you know, I did daytime television and commercials. I did a lot of commercials, good commercials. They paid. Molson's beer, I was a Dutch skier. Gatorade, I was a catcher, you know, flying off the mask and guzzling, gulping down Gatorade for a commercial. But it fed the theater, but it couldn't feed the family. So my wife and I, who she had also been a graduate from the American Academy of Dramatic Arts a few years before me, and we created a production company. And so we did productions, and we did them for nonprofits for the most part, and connected with a DC nonprofit that had the funds and the desire and saw talent in us to direct at the Kennedy Center. We did shows. We were tapped on the shoulder to do wonderful things and truly expand our skill set. And so we had a good run of that. And I met Miles, my co-author of A Line in the Sand, which is a new book, historical fiction. Okay, so as I was saying, Miles Spencer, my good pal, and it says in the book, you know, these two guys, just different characters, Magnus and Finn, but that's Miles and Wells. You know, the day they met, they were lifelong friends the day they met. And that's true. It's just one of those things. You know, we know each other's families and children and wives and been through a lot. So I'm through with the job in D.C. as chief operating officer of a foundation, and seeing Miles on the way to Colorado. And do you know anything about T.E. Lawrence? Yes. Why? How do you know? And I said I was going to do a one-man show. And I actually talked with Hal Holbrook at an event at the White House. And he and I were just hanging out, kind of bored with what was going on. Or just, you know, same old stuff. People drinking and partying and enjoying and waiting for the president to come in to get pictures. But it was wonderful being in the White House. At any rate, but it was even better talking with Hal Holbrook. And I said, you know, because he knew the people that I had been acting with. He knew John Strasberg. He knew Geraldine Page, F. Murray Abraham, just many people that I acted with in New York. And I said, you know, I loved your show. I saw it in Santa Barbara in 77. Oh, great. Nice. And I said, so I was looking for an idea for myself, and I came up with T.E. Lawrence. He said, that's perfect. I said, why is it perfect? He said, well, you know, Peter O'Toole. I said, I'm not Peter O'Toole. And what happened, the reason I'm not doing it, he goes, what? I said, he was 5'5" and a half. And that was integral to his character. He was 5 feet. I mean, Joseph, think of a person, your mom, maybe your wife, or 5'5" and a half, and he's a man.
Right,
and you know, and he did all these phenomenal things. And so noted that. Anyway, Miles said, well, we could still do it. We'd get a bigger chair. You could play him on stage. We'll go to Choate. We'll go to Westport Playhouse. And what ended up happening is that we were introduced to a Broadway producer. We presented the idea in 10 minutes. She was down for it. That was 20 years ago. We've had 4 different writers that we've commissioned. We've blown a lot of money and a lot of time. But back then, in 2005, we looked at each other and we said, you know what? We got to go. Yeah, we've got to go. So we went to the Middle East. We figured it out. It took 8 months to pull that together. And we left in the spring of 2006. and it was epic. We were going to feed the information that we got to the actor that was going to play Lawrence. You know, we didn't have the actor, but we figured we would bring them back to Saudi and Jordan and Syria and Israel. This is where we went. We followed T.E. Lawrence's path during the Arab revolt. And the reason for doing that is that we wanted to understand what triggered 9/11. And from the prior reading, Seven Pillars of Wisdom, and learning about all the declarations, learning about Lawrence and his leading the Arabs with the thought that they were going to get their independence, not only from the Turks and Germans, but from the world. They were going to have their own Arab state. And there were assurances, there were letters, there were agreements, and then there were secret things. And when they were revealed, and by the time it got to the Paris Peace Conference, dealing with how to handle the Middle East, they stuck with agreements that were made in 1916, even before the end of the war between the British and the French. British were going to have mandates and spheres of influence in certain areas, and the French were going to get Syria. And what's underneath all that? Well, maybe in the podcast we'll dip into, what was it? What did they want? You know, they were displacing people and telling people where to go, you know? And so, with that in mind, we found that Lawrence was a man that understood the structure there. He loved the region, the purity of the area that we're talking about, Saudi, Syria. He had been there on archaeological digs as a younger man, and it was sort of an escalation in his knowledge and learning Arabic. And then suddenly he's commissioned, the war breaks out, and he lands, you know, positions where people need to know what's going on there. Lawrence, phenomenal individual, and he was put in positions that just met his dream. But he had, you know, two different opposing forces, his love of the people and wanting to do the right thing by them, and his masters is, you know, the British Empire, wanting what they wanted. So we could go anywhere you'd like to from here. Miles and I did the trek in the spring of 2006. We focused on the play, had many writers, four different writers, and voluminous notes on their work. And that was over a period of basically 15 years. In the last 5 years, we've been with a woman, and the only one that's not British. Everyone was British or Irish in as playwrights and known quantities, but I don't need to go into that. It's just that they weren't able to do the research and provide the play that we were looking for that would bridge an understanding of how we got into this Middle East mess, which goes back to the First World War and the way things were settled at the Paris Peace Conference.
And yeah, so it was such an intense time, and it was such a time of great change, not just in the world, but in the Middle East especially. And it laid the foundation for the problems that exist there today.
Absolutely, yeah.
So anyone who's seriously a fan of historical fiction or history or time travel epics are bound to enjoy your book, A Line in the Sand. What exactly inspired you and Miles to begin writing this book? I know you said you've been working on a play version of it for several years, but what about the novel specifically?
The novel, well, let's back up just for a brief moment. The purpose and the intention for going on the trek was to understand post 9/11, what was really going on? Are the raging headlines of war accurate? Is that what it's like with the people? Could T.E. Lawrence be so off course with his love for the area and the people that it wouldn't translate to today? Well, we found out that it does. And there's commonalities that are just inherent, and they have a different culture. So that was about 9/11. We found out, and if you read the book, you'll see what we discovered. The writing of the book, the desire to write it was always in play. We had many, many pictures and video, and we had started writing what we thought would be the book. And it wasn't until after October 7th, 2023. And that's when we realized, you know, we've been watching over the years, history repeating and repeating and repeating, the crisis and the anger just getting heightened to hatred. And so with October 7th, it's like, what was it? What is it that just drives that kind of horrific behavior, the hatred and the cruelty? And we felt some of that when we were there in 2006, and it escalated to the point of, you know, a concert, and those people just brutalized. But what was behind that? And then the retribution. It's all retribution. It's like a retribution exchange. And then it becomes righteous retribution. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And so we had to write the book. We started writing it, and we did it very quickly because we had so much. We wrote dispatches every day when we were on the track. So we uploaded. That was part of our fundraising. We said we would. We had a BGAN satellite set up in the middle of the desert. We could, you know, triangulate and tie into the internet in 2006 and upload our thoughts of what we were experiencing as we were going along. And so October 7th, the next week, we said it's now or never. And we spent the next 4 months doing nothing else. It was total immersion. Came up with it's like, are we going to do this fiction? It was like asking the same questions we were asking and authors and writers were asking us, you know, how far do we go with dramatic license? It's like, no, not for the play. No spin on any of this in the play. And that was very hard on the writers, but we had a lot of information about what works, what doesn't work, and actually realized, do historical fiction. And it was Miles who said, you know what? We could do a travel device. I said, that's brilliant. And you know what it should be? It should be a dagger. And it should be a dagger. And so we're thinking, you know, Raiders of the Lost Ark. We're thinking of, you know, Alexander Dumas and the you know, exciting adventures, you know, the gentleman. And we realized that that would be the hook to pull people in to a story. But the basis of this story is very serious. And it comes through our two protégés, Jeremy and Abdu. Jeremy is a Jew, and mom teaches, you know, Middle Eastern history at Columbia. But he's split between Israel and New York, and he's in the IDF reserves. And then an Arab, Abdu, and they're based on real people. And their concerns, which was really from 2006, resonate today. It's the same thing. It's both sides, love of country, belief in their religion, love of family, and questioning, you know, the government's choices. These two fellas met at a camp. Now, it's a real camp in real life. It's called Seeds of Peace. It's a camp that's been around since 1993, where high school thought leaders from Israel and from Palestine meet in Maine for the summer to deal with conflict resolution. And it's just an amazing organization. We call it Seeds of Hope in the book. But Abdu and Jeremy met there in the summer, and there's a bond and a tie-in with each other. And then there's another fellow in the story, Sinjin, who's a California dude. He's a fun character. But these young guys, and there are women too, we met many of them. Our fundraising model was to give 25% of our fundraising to Seeds of Peace. We identified them as the one to get it, which allowed us inside their tent and opened up doors when we were in Saudi Arabia and when we were in Jordan, Syria, and Israel, because there were students, our campers, that had been there. So we heard stories directly from them. It's like hearing a story from a guy that's 30 years old and he was in the IDF after he went to the camp. I mean, he said, yeah, I came home and I knew that. I didn't tell anyone. I went right into IDF, Israeli Defense Fund Force, right when he got home after being in the camp. And I said, did you have, he said, yes, I had conflicts. Of course I did. But I had to follow orders. But I'm in touch with my friends. And we have that in the book. We have it where the friends are actually helping each other out to avoid potential death.
Yeah, it's important to emphasize here that members of the IDF, are they don't really have an option. I mean, you can't choose to not be a part of the IDF. It's literally...
Correct.
Every single correct. Adult male, and I think females are also yes. required to join yes. as well. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I had a friend in another situation, Talil Rappaport, and she was talking, we went to a camp in Great Falls, Montana when I was younger. I was selected kind of like the Seeds of Peace. It was my town, the Rotary, or someone elected me to go to this encampment for citizenship when I was 15 years old. And I met Israelis and Puerto Ricans. I mean, I'm in Vermont, right? I wasn't living in New York City, but I met all the people, you know, from, it's like 1970. And it was a great thing. So I really tied in when I discovered Seeds of Peace with my encampment when I was 15 in Great Falls, Montana, and meeting all these international people and learning to get along. And you know, this is at the time of Attica riots. And I mean, there were just things going on that was, and the whole flower power and drugs and head shops and long hair for guys and walking, just all different things. So Seeds of Peace was wonderful to meet. Janet Wallach's husband had passed on. She was running the organization out of New York. We met with her and she was thrilled and that we were doing this. And I will say we were trained, Joseph. We didn't just haphazardly walk into Saudi Arabia. I mean, it was a process and training, physical, mental, and practical stuff. So the book is historical fiction, and the fiction is there to entertain as it informs. And so beneath it, there's messages, and they're in there, and they're real. And I don't think some people have said, well, did that really happen? Yeah, a version of it. Really? Yeah, really. You know, did the guy in the car that was driving through the night that pulled out the Johnny Walker in Saudi Arabia and started, you know, just crying and blubbering and just, you know, just exploding with this horrible, horrible grief.
Yeah. And very powerful scene.
We felt that. And even when we met His Royal Highness Prince Khalid bin Faisal bin Abdulaziz, and we didn't meet him before, but we were invited to his majlis. So we were Westerners in 2006, sitting across from all these desert Bedouin camel owners that were there to have audience with the prince of the province. To settle grievances or to talk about what was going on, the ears and eyes of the desert. And so it's just time with these guys and looking across, they're lined up along the wall, and it's like something out of a biblical movie. Staffs and thick and big, wide girths and beards and some dyed with henna but you couldn't tell their age. They all looked 100, weather beaten. But Prince Khalid, afterwards, he stopped. We stepped aside for him to pass outside, and it was nighttime. It was misty. And he stopped, and he called us by our names, Mr. So-and-so, Miss So-and-so. And we say in the book, using the Magnus and Finn, he said, "Please join me for dinner. You'll see that we are not all terrorists." And it was like, holy cow. And we ran into that a lot with people that were contrition. Getting in there was a YEO organization. The way we figured it out to get started and get to Jeddah, the first spot on the trek, was through a young entrepreneurs organization. Miles had written a book based on the Money Hunt television series that we had done. It's like 27 rules for the entrepreneur. And so we used that, and we found a sponsor, and it took months. I mean, it just didn't happen. It wasn't overnight. Then we discovered that at the time, to get a visas, it goes through so many different offices, and there's so many checks, and it has to be, the people have to verify who is coming. So it was down as Miles was this star, having been the co-host of a television show and written a book, and this YEO organization. These are all, young princes, sons of princes. And they, were the upper crust. And so there was believability. And well, who's this other guy? Wellington Jones. Well, he's his bodyguard. And that's how we got in, He takes care of Mr. Spencer's needs and his security. We had credibility, and we had a letter that's signed by the prince that allowed us to free passage to go through Saudi Arabia. And we went up to Damascus. It's 1,100 miles. Then we went into Israel, and we went through 39 checkpoints, Joseph. And we were trained to what to look for. We were trained how to walk, how to talk, how to dress, where to walk, how to eat, how to deal with technical gear, how to say hello, how to look directly in the eyes, how to sit where your feet are supposed to be, use your right hand, eat, many different things. But and we were doing it, and it started from day one. And never walk the street in the same place. And number one, remember this. This is from Janie Lothar Pinkerton, SAS major retired, Irish Guard, specialty kidnap and ransom and checkpoints, the private secretary appointed by the Queen of England to Prince Harry and Prince Charles, Prince William. And we just happened to get him through our KNR insurance company. And they said, "Oh, you need to talk with Jamie. He worked with Charlie Borman and Ewan McGregor on their Long Way Around."
Wow.
And so it's a similar thing. So we had a chat with him, and he was in. And so he's dealing with the royal family, and he was dealing with us for a while. And we took what he said as gospel. When he said within the borders of Saudi Arabia, you get kidnapped, you're gone. The time with Jamie was extremely valuable because of his clarity and no messing around, and he didn't dramatize anything. He was very straight on how to behave and present ourselves, and clear about knowing one thing: you're being watched. Wherever you are being watched. And that ripples through. You can see it in movies. The people driving through in the Jeeps, and they've got a, whatever. gun on the back and so forth. No, you're being watched and you need to be aware of that. And when you come up to a checkpoint and no one's in uniform, back up, get out of there. There will always be guns, assault rifles, low, you know, gauged guns, 22s. Depends upon where you are, but the way I'm hearing you're going to go through, first of all, we went through under the wire. We did not register with the consulates in the countries or the cities. He said, you're not going to do that. I said, no. We want to see free of all of that. And so we trained for that. And that training in practice there, we were just under a month, under 4 weeks, was exhausting. By the time we got to the crossing at the King Hussein Allenby Bridge, and it's like it was a choice. And he said, fly. Jamie said, just fly in. You don't have to go. No, we want to go across every single border on foot as Americans. And so if we had a car and driver, we did have a travel company that worked with us that we approved and they approved of us because it was very unusual what we wanted. First of all, we're going to an area of conflict. It's a war nearby. You know, it's volatile. 10 days before we went, two hotels in Amman, Jordan. Jordan that Jamie said was westernized. You'll find that it's not as strict in their culture, and it's more westernized, and there's wonderful places to go to, blah, 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 in Amman, and the Acropolis, and this and that. And so, yeah, two hotels were smacked with bombs by terrorists, and one was the one we were set to be in. And it's like, are we going to still stay at this place? Absolutely. Are we going to go across? You know, we'd seen the news, buses getting blown up. I mean, we saw it, you know, with the Boston Marathon. We saw it, we'd seen it, not Boston Marathon, you know, we've seen it. But at this bridge, yeah, it's a thing. And when you're standing on that bus, like it says in the chapter, it's tense. And it's tense because you don't know what's going to happen. And people are quiet and their eyes are darting and it's hot and the bus isn't moving. It's not going. And it's like, why are we sitting here for 45 minutes? And the driver, you know, suddenly, I'm tall enough, I could see over and see the driver opens his side window and he's talking to someone. It's like, what's going on? We just stayed alert. Windows on the bus, can't budge them. They don't, you know, up or down. No, they're up. And it's sweltering hot. And we're standing in the aisle like in a rave, shoulder to shoulder with people. Backpacks, you know, on our bellies, pulled in front of us, and nothing gets lost. And the things we have in that backpack were essentials. We had the personal locator beacon that I was speaking of. You activate that in times of mortal danger. That's when you activate it. And we had the insurance enough to send in, and you know, help to get us out. I'll leave it at that.
World War I, we've sort of talked about in a nebulous kind of way, at least in the periphery, with certain characters and subjects. It seems a lot of the history and the discourse surrounding the conflict has to do with European battlefields. This makes a little bit of sense. It was the most violent area of the war, millions of casualties as opposed to tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands in the Middle East campaign. So why do you feel that this is the case and there hasn't been as much history surrounding the Middle East campaign specifically? Maybe there is a lot of history around someone like T.E. Lawrence, for example. But why exactly is the rest of the theater not as talked about?
Well, it's talked about, I think, in a different way. First of all, going back to the time France was being decimated and the focus was there. The war, the revolt, the Arab revolt, what happened was is that there were people from the British colonial office and war office that were reaching out to King Hussein, Sharif Hussein, who was the most powerful Arab. Now, the Hussein family, that is, Faisal Hussein became the first king of Iraq, and his brother became the first king of Transjordan, that became Jordan, and the Hussein family is still, you know, the royal family of Jordan. But it was a sideshow, and the main thing that was happening there was protecting, number one, with Egypt and the Suez Canal, and that was vitally important to protect that from Germans and from the Ottoman Empire getting control of any of that. And so you had General Allenby, who was the head of the expeditionary forces, very powerful, very well-liked and wonderful general, and then Lawrence. And Lawrence, after he turned the Arab revolt around from losing horribly to winning Aqaba, taking over that supply fort from behind, it's really, and we were there, we saw exactly why the guns were facing, the Turkish guns of the fort were facing the bay, because that's where people would attack. It's just so impossible to get in from the desert for any forces of any size to come from behind and overthrow that fort. Well, they did, and they did it in minutes. It took 2 months to get there, but they did it in minutes. And it was Lawrence's idea. And he had he just was charismatic, and he won over the number one Hawitat warrior, Auda Abu Taya, who had influence and was so liked by the other tribes. And they started out with 17 guys, and it took 7 months to work their way around behind to take that fort. And they ended up with hundreds, because Auda was able to influence and bring other tribe members from different tribes to join them in this revolt there. So to me, you have two countries, France and Germany, are fighting the war. I mean, France and Britain are fighting the war against the Germans in France. It's trench warfare. The machine guns of the Germans is just mowing down people like they did in Gallipoli, just mowing down. The officer's handbook in the British army hadn't changed. An officer rides his horse, he draws his saber, and says, "Charge!" Shouts, and everybody goes forward, and the Germans were just wiping them out. And then they had to dig in, blah, blah, blah. So the focus is there because it was just, that's where the need was. But the British were aware of a need, and that was oil. Churchill had outfitted the ships with oil. And their competitors in the shipping world was Germany. And Germans wanted to rule the seas as much as the British did. And the Germans were working a railroad from, they called it the Berlin to Baghdad Railway, but it's actually, it was Constantinople to Baghdad, and then from Baghdad to Berlin was by railroads. And so the Germans were building railroads. And so there was, as the war was developing, First World War, the British realized they'd have to have a position in the Middle East, or where we're going to lose a potential asset, which is oil.
And they already did a little bit of it by annexing Egypt formally in, I think, 1914.
Yeah. So in 1916, Clemenceau and Lloyd George get together and they say, you know what? If we win this war, and it's just barely, it's into the war, you know, there's another year and a half, 2 years left. And what would you like? And the French said, well, we want Syria. Well done. Good. We'll support that. France says, well, what would you like? Well, we'll take a piece of Basra over here and this and that. And we'll just create mandates. I mean, those people don't know how to rule themselves. You're going to need help. French says, yes, may we? Of course. You take care of that. We'll take Syria. And so they created these spheres of influence that became mandates, that became law. And they drew up. They had a man, Mark Sykes, and on the British, and Georges Picot on the French. Georges Picot, you know, a wise man and a young amateur, Mark Sykes, very ambitious, get together, and they divided up the Middle East to suit the British and the French. Period. They disregarded wells. They disregarded tribes. They didn't know anything about it. Mark Sykes knew a little bit, but he thought that doing this was good. Meanwhile, they're encouraging and sending arms and gold to this irregular army. An irregular army is someone that does not know how to fight. They do not know combat. They're irregular. They are not fighting the normal, you know, mano mano, shoot. One dies, one lives. And just, you know, that process. And it was Lawrence, with his background in Carchemish and his survey of the Sinai Peninsula and understanding the terrain and then seeing, knowing Crusader history with Saladin and his run-in with the Assassins. The Assassins was a group you couldn't put your finger on. You didn't know where they were. And they were political killers. And at one point, Saladin, who is a great Crusader warrior during the Third Crusade, is ready to siege the Assassins' castle. And he realizes he's endangering his head. And so they say, well, we'll protect you, his people. And he's new there. He's got a tent. So they put ash around the tent and all this stuff to ensure that no one crosses it. In the middle of the night, he wakes up and there's a poison dagger that says, we invite you to leave or die. And he has nobody knew how that got in there. And it's something that intrigued Lawrence when he visited the same castle and with his knowledge, and he realized in order to work with these non-soldiers, he would have to do something else. And he realized the camels, their knowledge of the desert, their ability to withstand the harshness, the extremes of the desert, and that there's a rail line, a railroad, the Hejaz Railroad, that was built by the Turks and Germans, that goes to, you know, south into Medina, so that people can go to Hajj and to Mecca to disrupt it. He figured out to be a vapor, a gas, invisible, like the Assassins. And it's called guerrilla warfare. He wrote the encyclopedia definition of guerrilla warfare. He was asked to, based on his experience. And so it was not about killing. It was about disrupting. And for the Arabs that joined him, they weren't trained. They knew how to ride camels fast. They knew how to disappear. They were wily, wily, you know? And the thing that they got was the booty. Dash a train down. It's not killing all the people on train. It's blow up the train tracks, disrupt the spine of the Turks. And have them thinking they'll never know when we're going to come. They'll never know when it's going to happen.
It was a highly effective strategy.
Well, they put up posters in the Damascus train station that said, if you're an Arab, don't get on this train. You will die. And that was just part of the psyops, you know? It was just scare them.
Wow.
Scare them.
So we've talked a lot about the Middle East And we've talked a lot about the past of the Middle East. We've talked a little bit about the present. You've talked a lot about your experiences there. And I feel like we can't really talk about it without understanding the effects of European and American colonialism, and not just colonialism, but neocolonialism. So why are these powers and these forces like colonialism, why are they so effective at controlling the populace? And how does this adversely affect both parties?
Well, first of all, I question how you determine effectiveness. What's effective? Peace? Agreeability? No. It didn't happen. That colonial gaze, that righteous gaze, it's like Balfour at the hearth with his elbow up on the hearth and he's wearing tails, and above the hearth is a portrait of Balfour. And he's looking. So it's a portrait of a portrait. I mean, it's like, are you kidding me?
Balfourception.
Yes, and Balfour was the one that promoted the Balfour Declaration, which was establishing a homeland for the Jewish, for Jews in Palestine. And so it's not effective. It is no more. I mean, we go back to Eddie Izzard. He's such a wild comedian, but he's got this thing about, you know, do you have a flag? If you don't have a flag, you have to have a flag and a gun. And that gives you your rights to the land. And so it is resources, Joseph. Mm-hmm. Look what's going on now. It's resources, always. Oil. What does the United States want from Ukraine today? I'm talking about the President of the United States today.
And it's those minerals.
Correct. Resources. And so it's, you know, there's something about the one that's strongest is going to win, period. The one that has power. And it's like, look, I'm going to set you over here. Now, you just take it easy because we're going to help you. You understand? Just be calm. Because we want a little piece of that. But we're going to help you. So don't fight back, or we'll have to fight you. We don't want to get to that. And it's the mentality, it's man, it's mano against mano, man against man. And it's everywhere. It's part of our human DNA. It's part of our survival, our concept of what we're supposed to be, supposed to have. And then when someone says, bang, you're dead. And the guy says, oh, yeah? You really? Well, I'm going to take retribution. I'm going to, you know, double that. you got one, I'm going to get two. And, you know, it's victims of victims.
Yeah, it's a vicious cycle. It's really sad. It's a cycle.
And retribution, I mean, it's a game. It's not a game, but it's a constant exchange of retribution.
Yeah.
And how far do we go? And that's why we went to the Middle East in the first place. You know, look, it was a year and a half before that we saw the sign on the ship and the jet land and our president get out and he said, mission accomplished. No way. And we're saying, what is this? How far do we go? 9/11, Magnus says it in the book. He said his thought was, it was an act of retribution.
Yeah, it was a counterattack.
Correct. And it's a thought. You can't tag me or Miles or you for saying that. It's just trying to understand what is this and then how far do we go? For sure, someone hits you. You know, I've been hit. Bam. You hit them back, right? But how far do we go? Lawrence, when he was less than 50 miles from the end of the war, hitting Damascus. He was a day, 2 days away from Damascus. They were in Taphus, and Talal, a warrior that was with him from that town, saw what all the Turks in their, you know, scorched earth policy, as they were running away because they were losing the war, the atrocities they did, and Lawrence saw it, and it was, they all went over the edge. Talal charges into the Turks, they blow him up, he's gone. And Lawrence just says, no prisoners. And they did, his warriors did the exact same thing that the Turks did. Horrible things to pregnant, horrible things to everyone.
Yeah.
There was nothing left to the imagination. And it went on for 36 hours. Now, what made Lawrence flip? What made Hamas flip? Go to that, there's no atonement, hatred, to that level of hatred where there's no turning back. And then the retaliation from the opposing side with Hamas.
It's important to point out too, Hamas was created in the 1980s as a reaction to, you know, Israeli imperialism, Israeli colonialism, you know, settlers in the West Bank, etc. Because in the 1970s, there was the huge PLO movement, which gained a lot of traction, but that gave way to the present organization of Hamas, which surprisingly enough supports a two-state solution.
Right. Well, we, as a third party looking at it, I will say that, and we handed our passport over more than 39 times, checkpoints, but we had them over in hotels, if we were in hotels, or just all different police, different times. The passport was our identity. And as soon as people saw it, you know, it's American. It says the United States of America. Passport, United States of America. And it's a blue cover. And they just like, Americi? Yes. And the ones that could speak that weren't just in official capacity, they were saying, I'm so surprised you're here. We're so sorry about what happened. And that's everyone, pretty much everyone. But it still didn't, you know, the tension and the focus and the crossing. And, you know, I was talking about being on the bus and seeing the people that go through that every day, you know, and having to go through that apartheid wall, figure out how to get through, you know, legitimately, and to go from one side of the city to the next to get to work. And then being, you know, just examined and pushed with questions at immigration, at Israeli immigration. And it's not being said out of anger, out of personal anger or impatience, because we endured whatever we needed to endure. And that was that was real. And it wasn't there just to give an opinion about. It was there to state, this is what's going on.
Yeah, brutal reality of what is happening.
Yeah, you come up with whatever you want to think, but this is what we experienced, and we tried to be as, you know, unbiased as possible. I mean, didn't try. It was just deal with the real thing. Tell that. No spin. You know, and some of it in the book is fiction. And like I was talking about the man that was drinking that, Yeah, that's in the book, but the real story is more harrowing, much more harrowing than that ride in that car. We put it in that car as a part of the fiction, and that did happen with an individual. What he said, all of that was real, but the real situation would raise the hair off your head. I mean, and I won't discuss that for my safety and the individuals, because the real one was real, as I said, much more harrowing than it was. But we wanted to get it in there.
Yeah.
So
yeah,
those are just real experiences, you know.
And that's one of the more powerful parts of the book, certainly. And we've talked a lot about the Arab-Turkish conflict, which made up a huge portion of World War II, especially the Great Arab Revolt. So let's imagine a world where maybe those last 36 hours outside Damascus don't happen, and there is still some level of kindred spirits between the Arabs and the Turkish people, and it's decided we're going to keep the Ottoman Empire around as, you know, maybe in a lesser capacity, but it's still going to maintain suzerainship over the quote-unquote Middle East or Muslim world. Mm-hmm. What do you think that world looks like with an Ottoman Empire, which is still more or less having its 1914 boundaries intact, save for, no, they already lost the European stuff, I apologize. But what do you think of that world?
I don't begin to know how to respond because there's a side of it from, it was bound to fall, the Ottoman Empire.
That's sort of my opinion too, yeah.
It was principled, a real principle to the whole thing was these guys aren't playing fair. They're ruthless, and then now they know how to fight because, you know, the Germans have taught them how to really be a soldier. And, you know, there's a whole thing with the Armenians. It's never discussed.
True.
The massacre. And we know about, you know, the Holocaust. We know about, just a number of different levels of atrocities. But it's not a legitimate question. Excuse me. I'm not putting you down. I'm saying.
Oh, no.
There's no, it's just, there are so many tragic situations that have stemmed from that time. And it's all been an effort to do what people thought was right in the moment, even with the declarations. I mean, they did what they thought was right and what they could. It's so serious where we are right now. And particularly when I'm talking about resources and how the most powerful go in and they want the resources from the land, we want gold, we want the diamonds, we want the oil, we want the sugar cane, you know? Right?
We want uranium and lithium today.
Now it's uranium and lithium. Right. And so how we acquire that is, I don't know. It's just such a different world. And it's almost reverted back in the last little bit of time, months, where we are the hubris is unbelievable. It's just shocking.
Yeah. It has so much to do, I feel like, just beyond with just Trump's election and everything, the refugee crisis. Mm-hmm. Those obviously play a huge factor. But those are influenced by countless other things, like what we're talking about. They're influenced by the civil war in Syria, which is a state created with many different religions, ethnicities, et cetera, et cetera. Which was for the longest time a French protectorate.
Yeah.
And you can take your pick, like, Israel-Palestine. Those are two states that were created artificially by Balfour through a declaration. And it was always based on some sort of, and this is the wildest part to me, with all colonialism in the Middle East and North Africa. There's always this idea, oh, we need to protect women, we need to protect women's rights, while at the same time, someone like Balfour literally voted against women's suffrage back in Great Britain. So he clearly didn't care about women's rights that much. There was obviously something behind it. And like you were saying, it has to do with resources. It has to do with power projection. It has to do, you know, with this, the unipolar world that we were once living in, now becoming multipolar, which is what it was like back in World War One. You have several branches of power now, as opposed to the single one, which was the United States for the longest time. Now you have a Chinese branch of power. You have the Russian sphere of power. You have the European sphere of power. You know, the African sphere of power. All these places are going to start asserting themselves more and more, for better or worse, in the coming years, I think.
Yes, they'll be chiming in. Well, one of the things that people don't know about, and it is in the book, our book, A Line in the Sand, is that, and it was Lawrence that set it up. Lawrence said to Faisal, look, this Balfour Declaration establishing a Jewish homeland is going to go through. You need to meet with Chaim Weizmann. The two of you, representing your people, need to meet man to man and have an agreement between you. What do you say to that? And he said, this is all part of setting you up for us to go to, you know, when it comes down to it, we have to show you as a advanced thinker. You're not what people think Arabs are. And that you have, you're worldly. You have an understanding of what's going on. And you have an opinion. And your opinion counts because you're representing all these people. So he set it up. They met. And they have the Faisal-Weizmann agreement. And it was allowing Weizmann to come in with the Zionists and the Arabs being, you know, 90% Arabs, Muslim, in the area. And Faisal, and just before the end of the meeting, he said, wait a minute. And he said, I want to add something. And he wrote out in his own in hand the codicil that he wanted, that he would agree to this and to following, to supporting this homeland, as long as the British followed through on their promises to the Arabs. If they do not, that all, you know, basically all bets are called off. No, I withdraw my support. And of course, the British did not come through. They, at the Paris Peace Conference, Gertrude Bell, T.E. Lawrence, Amir Faisal, were trying to reverse the lines in the sand that Mark Sykes and Georges Picot came up with, and that Clemenceau and Lloyd George agreed to. And they shook hands before even the Paris Peace Conference. They said, let's just get this one clear between us. And they said, it stays. We're not going to change it. Well, Mark Sykes came to the Paris Peace Conference knowing that he wanted to support a change in what he had set up with Georges Picot in the Sykes-Picot agreement. He got the Spanish flu and died. Boing! Just like that. Wow. And he realized his mistake. He said, this will not work. Dividing, you know, Mesopotamia and the Ottoman Empire up the way they did. And so, and he tried. He voiced it to Lawrence and to Faisal, and there was nothing he could do. And it was all in the very beginning of the Paris Peace Conference. And he was like in the first wave of people, and he died. And many, many, many did, you know, like COVID.
Yeah.
It was epidemic.
Yeah. And like COVID, the Spanish flu got a lot of pushback from more conservative elements about wearing masks, about, you know, vaccines. This is a very similar story.
So Lawrence felt he had betrayed Faisal because it was, he thought that if they got to Damascus first, no matter what people said about the Sykes-Picot, that it would demonstrate the leadership and the abilities of the Arab people, and that it would, they would not go through with that agreement, but they did.
And for anyone who's interested, I highly recommend you read the Faisal Weissman agreement. You have the preamble in your book, I believe, Wells. But the full thing is available on like UN.com. It's a very, you can find it.
Yes.
It's one of the most powerful historical documents I've ever read. Anyone who reads it will understand exactly why. I mean, it's a document which doesn't talk about retribution. It doesn't talk about what's owed to us. It talks about we're a kindred people. We've always been a kindred people. We're related genetically. We're related, you know, ethnographically. We have the same ancestors. We have the same religious and holy figures. It's a really beautiful piece of work, and in a way, it sort of embodies a way forward for the region, because it talks about self-government, it talks about, you know, the rights of the people living there, and acknowledges the differences between them while accepting that they're all at the end just people. With that in mind, if you were approached, Mr. Jones, if you were approached tomorrow by a huge committee of world leaders, Trump's there, you know, maybe Putin's in the background, Macron is there, he's smiling, Keir Starmer is there, and they're like, Wells, you've been there, how do we fix it so that they have self-government and that people still live peaceably? What do we do? You're the only one who can fix this problem, Wells.
you have to give up your oil. You have to give up.
You have to change literally everything about your society first, and then we can talk about.
This is real easy. You know, you just, all you got to do is stop doing what you're doing and feed the people. Feed them.
Wow, Wells, you sound like a communist.
Yeah, right. Well, I think I'm not. I don't even know what that means these days. It might be a good thing to say. I boil it down. We boil it down to the 5 points that are made in the book, the postscript. And it's an understanding that we came to. So we're finding that Magnus and Finn go on adventures to understanding. And in this case, it's a note that our play is called Dinner at the Majestic. The play that's the title of it. It used to be called The Lie in the Sand, but our new playwright, a woman, Liz, has retitled it because it centers around a day in the life of Gertrude Bell at the Paris Peace Conference, but it's a very specific day. It's February 19, 1919, and the key people in the drawing room, her hotel suite at the Majestic for dinner, is Emir Faisal and Lawrence, and others fly in and out. But we put this postscript in the book. Do you mind if I read it?
Go ahead. Yeah, I have it pulled up here too.
Yeah, okay. So it's a note that we've figured out that it's been written by or typed out by Lawrence, and very likely after he leaves the stage production, he types this out, and he leaves the stage in our production, which is, it's on the level, it's a Broadway, it's all Broadway producers, all of us, and so forth. So it's on Hotel Majestic Stationery, February 19, 1919. 1. Humanity has more commonality than difference. 2. People have to live somewhere. 3. Extermination is not legal. 4. Retribution never evens the score. 5. My favorite. Grandmothers deserve to know and love their offspring. That they live. We say, and I would say, you know, we humbly submit to the readers that they consider those notes. And that's how we landed. And what we found, that if people would be willing, I mean, leaders, you know, people moving, imagine taking 2 million Gazans and transporting them to Egypt and Jordan, away from their home. Can you imagine someone coming in and your mother-in-law answers the door and they knock her down and they come in and they just take over and just shove her out of her home or her room? That's what's going on. And we're so separate from it. We've seen the fire in California. My son, Casey, is an LA County fireman, and he's stationed at one of the 4 stations in Malibu. And he said the first 36 hours was nuts. And that's Casey and his, you know, he doesn't over-dramatize anything. And this guy is a postcard, strong fireman. And he's well-liked, and he is, you know, he's with the airborne division. And so we see the pictures from that, and there's a few people that have died, but we see pictures from Gaza, and you start putting the human element of how they were forced and the bombs that blew them up. I mean,
people in Gaza couldn't leave. They couldn't take their car and, you know, drive across the border.
Yeah. So it's a wild world. And we silo ourselves to protect our levels of empathy, or to, you know, to not hurt, or not to, you know, I have to go to work. You know, I've got my life, I've got my children, I've got grandchildren, I got this, I've got that, I'm going shopping, my car needs new tires. What do I care about Gaza? What do I care about Israel? What do I care? I mean, do you realize what's going on in the government right now? I had a podcaster say, I'm so sorry, Jose can't make the podcast tomorrow. It was actually a few days before that and before the podcast. He just was fired from his government job, and he's very concerned because money is so tight that they now have to move. And so can we do this, you know, like maybe the first part of April? Because I'd really like him to be a part of it. You know, it's a duo. And you start hearing stories. I know stories of people that lost their homes in California. But when you hear people that get fired, they showed up at work and they couldn't get in, or they were told, go home, you're done. Just out of the blue. And so we're dealing with real life-threatening stuff right now in our country.
Mm-hmm.
That, I mean, life-affecting, not threatening, but affecting stuff. And definitely. I think we have to pay attention and do as much the right thing as we can and be conscious and help others if we can, when we can.
Yeah.
You know, we're in it together.
Yeah. That's a really powerful statement. And that's a real good way to end it. Cause there's enough bad things going on already as is.
Yeah.
Without you bringing, you know, your own stuff into it, that's its own thing. Mm-hmm. And it's important that we all stick together and we all work together to help each other through this. I mean, people are losing their jobs. People are getting threatened to lose their jobs. You know, the economy is sinking every single day. I feel like I read a new story of some major brand shutting down stores mm-hmm. all over the place.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why I think it's important to have people like you on and historians, because you give context to the world we live in, and it helps to understand why we live in the world we live in. And your book does, I mean, the whole point of your book is to try and understand these lines in the sand that, you know, caused history to happen and pushed forward the human story. So as we're finishing up, I wanted to ask you this. This is always a fun question. If you could have dinner with any historical figure, living or dead, and I gave Miles this option, if you'd like to make it a triumvirate of people or a Mount Rushmore of people, you could, but who would you have dinner with and why?
T.E. Lawrence.
Hmm.
And I would, the hard part is that to get him to talk, it would just be to be in his presence, because I know so much about him and the sense of his brain, the size, the ability, the capacity, the endurance, the storytelling, the clarity, the liveliness, the poetry and how he is, and his truth and his experiences. Knowing them and just anything that he would be willing to offer to spend the time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he's a very interesting guy. I mean, one of the more interesting things you wrote about is his experience as a captive, and he was perhaps sexually assaulted.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was. Mm-hmm. And you speculated that this might have been this might have brought on latent, maybe homosexual feelings in Lawrence?
I don't know. I do have information between John Mack and a man that lived in Santa Fe, and it's been a while. I thought I had lost, and I just recently found the papers and the letters between John Mack, who wrote these, you know, the psychological approach to Lawrence. Man of Our Disorder, what was it called? Something. Prince of Our Disorder, John Mack. And he was a psychologist or psychiatrist. And John Mack and this man that I met in Santa Fe had this exchange, and he gave me the papers to read, and I had to sort through them. It was a little complicated, but it addresses that very specifically, the homosexual tendencies and whether it happened or and how it has affected his life, the rape, that is. And so it's a level that I've forgotten until now. Even when we wrote the book, I just thought in terms of him sitting there in the way we described what happened. I don't know that it was effective, that it really got exactly what I was trying to say, but he was in turmoil and in that scene. So there is evidence that he would have someone whip him.
Wow.
You know, and very unusual man, but and deeply connected with writers and artists, and Churchill asking him, please, begging him, 1 year, just give me 1 year to help solve this. And it was the ability in 1921, you know, to do the Cairo conference and to make amends, to do something that would be positive for Amir Faisal and the Hussein family. And they worked it out. That's when they created Jordan. They created Iraq. There was a name Iraq, and you know, but it was was officially tagged, and the first king was Faisal, Emir Faisal. And Gertrude Bell was there to help him in Baghdad. So sitting with Lawrence, that would be, it'd be fabulous. I just have such admiration for someone.
So as we finish up, how can people reach you? How can they find your work? And how can they keep up with you?
Well, I have not been on social media. I do have a LinkedIn page. It's Wells Tad Jones. And it's really, I've been on it for a while, but I'm just now posting and reposting podcasts between Miles and myself. The book is through Amazon. And we also have a very specific website, alineinthesandbook.com. And it's all about Magnus and Finn. And there's music. There's an Apple playlist that we have that goes along with the book. Very, very fun. And there's also a bot that you can ask any question about Magnus and Finn and this, anything involving the book to get information from the book. And so Miles, on the other hand, in the information that I sent you earlier, Joseph, there's a link to Miles' social media. He's very much, as an entrepreneur, into social media. He has 25,000+ followers and whatnot. And so this podcast, once it's ready to post, we'll send it out through his system, as well as, you know, through families and stuff like that.
Amazing. Amazing. I appreciate that. And I want to say, first of all, thank you so much for being on the show. I mean, I think we had a really great conversation. I really enjoyed it. I really enjoyed listening to you.
Joseph, it was terrific. Same with you. It was just a nice tone, I think. Did you interview Miles?
I did. I already interviewed him. The interview is all edited and everything. So I think how it's probably going to work is that your two interviews are going to come out separately. It's going to be part one, and this is going to be part two. It's fine if it's an hour 40. I mean, people are used to listening to like 2.5 hour podcasts for me.
Yeah.
And it'll probably come out the same week, because basically how it's going to happen is I'm working on my Puebloan series right now. The first episode just came out today. There's going to be three more. They're going to come out every 2 weeks. So in about a month and a half, you and Miles's interviews will come out probably within a few days of each other.
Oh, that's great. That's lovely. Yeah. I missed the first part. What is the three-part series on?
Oh, it's about the Puebloans, the Anasazi.
Got it.
Yeah. Yeah, you shouldn't call them Anasazi anymore, because that term actually means ancient enemies.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So they obviously have a problem with it. And it's a term that was given to them by the Navajo. So it's like, who are you to call us, you know, this random name that means ancient enemies?
Oh, that's cool, though. That's wonderful you're doing that.
Terrific. Yeah, it's a really interesting series. I think people are really going to like it, because it's different than all the other ones I've done. Usually everything I've done has been in like the 18th to 15th century, you know, in there. So there is enough historical content where you could really form a narrative each time. Mm-hmm. But with the Puebloans, there's very little information, especially for their first, 20,000 years of existence. They actually just found a 22,000-year-old handcart track dug into the dirt in New Mexico, I believe.
That's amazing.
Yeah, I mean, that changes the whole story of human evolution and human migration to the Americas, because usually the idea is like, okay, maybe 15,000 years ago, people were just coming across the Bering Strait, and, you know, they were just getting things going. Maybe they just got into, you know, the United States proper, the lower 48. But that was the extent. You know, there was never supposed to be any human activity, certainly prior to 15,000 BC. But the fact that this handcart was created 22,000 years ago and used by assumably humans. I mean, maybe there was some,
yeah,
it was Bigfoot, maybe, I don't know.
amazing.
But yeah, I just want to say thank you so much again for coming on. This has been a super nuanced issue, and you brought a lot of expertise to it. You brought the physical experience of you literally being there, speaking with the people, eating their food, enjoying their culture. It's a very powerful book. Anyone who's interested in history should pick it up and give it a read. So yeah, thank you so much again. And thank you to the audience, the listeners, for listening. I hope you'll tune in next time. Thank you.
If you like what you heard today, you can support us by donating on PayPal at Turning Tides Podcast 1. We would also appreciate it if you take the time to rate and review Turning Tides on whatever platform you use to listen, and share the show with your family and friends. It really helps us bring the show to more listeners. Thank you so much for the support, and thanks again for listening.